The Duke of Ellisford had learned to measure a room by how quickly the eyes left him, and the eyes in the Marwood Assembly left him very quickly indeed. He stood just inside the door with his cane planted before him, the scar that ran from temple to jaw catching the candlelight, and watched the gazes touch him and slide away to the floor, to the punch, to the safer faces of whole men. In that small flinching motion he had come to know better than his own name, pity. It was always pity. He had ridden home from the war expecting to be feared, and had found instead that he was only to be looked away from, and he had not yet decided which was the crueler. He had not wanted to come. His sister had insisted, in the relentless, gentle way of women who have decided a thing is good for you. So he had come and propped himself by the wall like a piece of the furniture that had been damaged in moving, and watched the dance go on without him, the young men leading out their partners, the music, the bright turning gowns, a country assembly carrying on its small joys, while the wounded Duke stood at its edge and was, by unanimous and unspoken agreement, not seen. It was easier, he had decided long ago, to not be seen than to be examined. When they looked away, he did not have to watch them deciding what to do with their faces. And then a young woman looked straight at him, and did not look away at all. He noticed her because of the not looking away. She stood near the window with an older lady in her charge, a companion, he judged from her plain gray gown, plainer than the merchant's daughters around her, a parson's quality to her, neat and unjeweled. She was fetching the older lady a cup of negus when she caught sight of him across the room, and where every other gaze in the assembly had performed its little flinch, hers simply rested on him, on the scar, on the cane, on the whole ruin of him, with a clear, warm, unhurried attention, as though he were a person and not an accident. And when he met her eyes, braced for the flinch, ready to make it easy for her by looking away first, she did not flinch. She smiled. Small and grave and entirely without pity. A smile such as one gives a man, not a wound. The Duke of Ellisford forgot, for a moment, to be bitter. He looked away first after all, he who had taught himself never to be the one caught looking, and his heart was doing something unfamiliar and undignified, and he was furious with himself, and he could not stop glancing back to see whether she had gone. She had not. She brought the negus to her lady and stood, and once more, across the whole bright width of the room, she looked at the man no one would look at, and inclined her head to him as to an equal. He did not cross to her. A man with a cane did not cross a ballroom. The crossing was a spectacle, the slow, uneven progress of it, and he had sworn he would never again limp the length of a room with society watching to see whether he would manage it. So he stood, gripping the silver head of his cane, and was angry and longed, and despised himself for longing. It was she who came to him. "You are the Duke of Ellisford," she said, arriving at his elbow with the older lady on her arm, neat and direct. "My charge, Mrs. Penhale, has been wishing this half hour to thank you, and I have been too cowardly to bring her over for fear you would think us forward. I have decided to be brave. Mrs. Penhale's nephew served under your command at the river crossing. He came home. She would like you to know that she prays for you nightly." The Duke looked down at her. She was small and gray, and her eyes were the steadiest thing in the room, and found he had nothing ready to say, because no one in 8 months had simply walked up to him and spoken of the war as a thing he had done rather than a thing that had been done to him. "Penhale," he said at last, low, "the signaller, he held the left when the bridge gave. A brave man." The old lady's eyes filled, and she pressed his free hand in both of hers, and said something he scarcely heard because the young companion was watching him say it, watching him be a commander again instead of a casualty, and her face had gone soft and bright, and the Duke of Ellisford understood that she had brought the old woman over not for the old woman's sake at all, but to give him, a stranger she pitied not at all, 1/4 hour of being a whole man. "Lucinda Kerr," she said, when Mrs. Penhale had been settled again, "I am Mrs. Penhale's companion. I am also, my father would have you know were he here, a parson's daughter, and therefore I will say plainly what better bred people will not." She tilted her head, and the candlelight caught a few strands escaped from her plain knot. "They are looking away from you, sir, the whole room. I have watched them do it all evening, and I think it is the worst manners I have ever seen, and I am sorry for it." He should have been offended, a man of his rank addressed so by a companion in gray. Instead, he heard himself say, with a roughness he had not used in months, "You looked."
"Yes, sir."
"Most cannot bear to." "Then most are cowards," said Lucinda Kerr, "and you are well rid of their gaze." It was never worth having. She looked at the scar, looked at it directly, the way she did everything, and there was no flinch in her, none. "It is only a mark, sir, that a brave thing was done. I cannot think why it should frighten anyone." The music turned, the dancers wheeled. the Duke of Ellisford stood at the edge of an assembly that had spent the whole night unseeing him, and was, all at once and for the first time in a year, entirely seen. He could not get her out of his thoughts. He learned, through the careful inquiries a duke may make, that the parson her father had died, that she had no fortune and no prospect but companionship, that she had taken the post with Mrs. Penhale because the old lady was kind, and the wages let her keep her late mother's small cottage rather than sell it. He learned she walked 2 miles each Sunday to the church where her father had preached, to keep his grave from going wild. He learned she had refused 2 posts in finer houses, because the families were unkind to their lower servants, and had taken less money to serve a kind old woman instead. He had his sister invite Mrs. Penhale to Ellisford for a fortnight's country air. Mrs. Penhale, of course, brought her companion. The estate undid most people. The long galleries, the silence, the wounded duke who haunted them with his cane, guests grew careful, lowered their voices, looked away. Lucinda Kerr did none of it. She walked the galleries asking him plainly about the portraits. She found the library and exclaimed over it without apology, and when he came upon her one wet afternoon reading by the great window, the rain silvering the panes behind her and a book open in her lap, she looked up and patted the seat beside her as though a duke sitting by a companion were the most natural thing in England. "Your library is wasted on you, sir," she said. "You scowl at the spines as you pass and never open one. I have been remedying it. This is the best of the lot." She turned the book toward him. "Read me the marked passage." "I cannot get the rhythm of it. I think it wants a deeper voice than mine." He had not read aloud in years. He had not done many things in years. He took the book, and his cane stood forgotten against the window seat, and the wounded Duke of Ellisford read to a parson's daughter by the gray light of the rain while the great house held its breath around them, and her face, listening, was the most beautiful thing he had seen since before the war. "There," she said when he had done, "I knew it wanted you." She said it simply and looked at him, and the look held a beat too long, and they both felt it, and the rain went on falling. "Miss Kerr," he said, his voice was unsteady, "why are you kind to me?" The question came out rawer than he intended. He had meant it half as a challenge. Kindness was suspect. He had learned that a duke's wounds attracted a particular sort of woman who hoped to nurse her way to a title. He watched her face for the calculation. There was none. "I am not kind to you," she said. "Kindness is what they imagine they are being when they look away to spare you, and it is a lie, and you know it is a lie, and so do I." She closed the book. "I am not kind to you, sir. I simply see you. There is a difference, and I think you have been starved of it so long you have forgotten the taste." She held his gaze. "You are not a thing that happened. You are a man who held a bridge so that other men's nephews could come home. The scar is the least interesting thing about you, and I have never once been able to understand why everyone else stares at it instead of at your eyes, which are far better worth the trouble." The Duke of Ellisford, who had not wept since the field hospital, found his vision blur and looked away, and felt her hand come to rest, light, warm, unhesitating, upon his where it gripped the book. "Don't," she said softly, "don't look away, you needn't with me, I have decided," and she smiled the grave small smile that had undone him across a ballroom. "I am not going anywhere, sir, unless you send me, and I should warn you I am very difficult to send." He turned his hand under hers. He did not send her. The fortnight became 3 weeks, and then a month, by a series of small dishonest extensions that fooled no one. He stopped propping himself by walls. When he walked the galleries now she walked beside him, slowing her own pace to his without ever once seeming to, so that the slowness became merely the speed at which 2 people who liked each other's company chose to go. He read to her every wet afternoon and several dry ones. He told her haltingly and then less haltingly, about the river crossing, about the men, about the long bad night since, things he had told no one, and she listened with her whole grave face, and never once said "poor man" asterisk, only "yes" asterisk, and "go on" asterisk, and "thank you for telling me" asterisk. "I'm in love with you," he said one evening abruptly by the fire, because he had never been a man for slow approaches and the war had taught him not to leave true things unsaid. "I am aware of every reason it is folly. I'm a scarred and broken down duke 12 years your elder who walks with a cane and frightens children, and you are young and good and ought to have a whole man who can dance with you, and I cannot give you the dancing, Miss Kerr. I will never again give any woman the dancing, and I—"
"Sir," she said.
"And I would not for the world burden you with—" Corin, she had never used his name, it stopped him utterly. She rose from her chair and came to stand before him, this small gray parson's daughter with no fortune and the steadiest eyes in England, and she took the cane from his hand and set it carefully aside, and took both his hands in both of hers.
I do not want the dancing, she said. I never cared a straw for the dancing. I want the man who reads me the passages that want a deeper voice. I want the man who held a bridge. I want the man who, when the whole world looks away, is brave enough to let one person look at him instead, for that is braver than the bridge, Corin, far braver, and I have watched you learn to do it this last month, and I have loved you more with each day you managed it. Her hands tightened on his.
You think you have nothing to give me. You have given me the only thing I ever wanted, which is to be needed by someone worth the needing. So do not speak to me of burdens. Marry me and be looked at and looked after and loved by a woman who will never once in her life flinch.
The Duke of Ellisford looked at her directly, without flinching, as she had taught him, and drew her in, and pressed his scarred brow to her soft one. And for a long moment neither of them said anything at all, while the fire burned and the rain came on again at the dark windows.
I have nothing to offer that you have not already taken better care of than I ever did, he said at last, his voice thick. The library, the galleries, the grave passages, myself, he drew back to look at her.
Yes. God help you for choosing it, but yes. A thousand times, Lucinda, marry me, let them look away all they like. I have stopped caring what they do with their eyes so long as you keep me in yours. They married in the small church where her father had preached, the one she walked 2 miles to tend, with Mrs. Penhill weeping happily in the front pew and the Duke's sister beside her. He walked up the aisle with his cane and his scar in the plain morning light, and not one soul looked away, because Lucinda Kerr was at the altar looking at him as though he were the only man ever made. And her looking made it impossible for anyone else to do anything but look too. The county, which had pitied him, learned to envy him instead. The wounded Duke of Ellisford, who had haunted his own galleries like a damaged thing, was seen now at every assembly with his wife on his arm, and if he did not dance, he held her hand at the edge of the floor and watched her laugh, and the watching had become the gladdest hour of his week. The cane stayed, the scar stayed. But the man who carried them had been, somehow, given back to himself by a parson's daughter who had simply refused to look away. Do you know, he said to her, years on, in the library where it had begun, the rain at the window as it had been that first afternoon, I went to that assembly certain I would stand by the wall and be unseen, as I always was, and come home no different than I went. And instead, said Lucinda, curled against his side with a book in her lap, I looked at you. And instead, the Duke of Ellisford agreed, lifting her hand to press his lips to it, you looked at me. The whole world had practiced looking away until it was perfect at it, and one parson's daughter in a grey gown looked straight at the worst of me and saw a man worth the trouble. He drew her closer. I will be looked away from no longer, my love, all my life, for you are always looking. And I have come to think that being truly seen by the right person is the only cure there is for any wound a man can carry.